This is episode 19 of The Living Reminders with Mary and Blake.
2% doesn't sound like much. But 2% of the entire planet, of every person on it, that's more than the world's 10 largest cities combined. It's 140 million people. And like that, they were gone.
From Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to The Living Reminders. It's a podcast dedicated to the show The Leftovers on HBO. We're still here, and so are you. So let's talk to Kevin Carroll. Suddenly I'm hit. It's the darkness of the dawn. And your friends are gone. And your friends won't come. So show me where you fit. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Mary Larson.
My name's Blake. And I feel like burning some houses down. What do you think?
WTF. What kind of place is Miracle, Texas?
Listen, we're going to save all of our analysis and everything for our next episode, which will actually be the first episode of the premiere. So we'll save all that stuff for then. But just the idea of this guy burning everybody's houses down because they don't really fit along with...
You know what? We got a new honey badger.
I'm not sure if Carrie Coon would be very happy with us if we gave Kevin Carroll.
She gets to have the honey badger for sure. But what is going on? What, you're a fireman. Why are you starting fire? Like, all of my friends who are firemen,
yep,
they take that stuff seriously.
They don't burn people's houses down just because they feel like
they come over to our house and they're like, when was the last time you had your chimney inspected? I think that flame is a little too close to the edge with a 2-year-old around the house. I'm like, whoa, excuse me.
are the batteries taken care of in your...
Smokey the Bear. All right, but that is not Mr. Murphy.
No, not at all. In fact, I think John Murphy is the exact opposite of that. And it's great because we actually have Kevin Carroll on today to speak with him.
That's right.
And I know this is a little unusual that we're having an interview as the first.
It's not unusual to have fun with anyone.
But you know, what we wanted to do is we wanted to thank all the listeners and everybody for coming back and watching the show, coming back to the podcast, getting a hold of what The Leftovers is. And I know after everybody watched that finale last night, I know the premiere last night, after everybody watched it, they're like, what the heck is going on? Who are these people? What was that opening? What's up with the new, like...
Where's the Leftovers?
Yeah, like, this is a whole new... I mean, it's still the same show. It still has the same DNA. But people, it's a little jarring to see what happens. And they want information. And this is the gentleman that you need to speak to in order to get information. Because that first episode was based pretty much around his character.
Yes.
And this is who we need to speak to.
Yes.
So, you know what? Enough screwing around. Let's just get to it. Let's get to the man that has the answers. What do you think?
Let's do it.
All right, let's do it.
Joining us today is Kevin Carroll, a wide-ranging and talented actor who's appeared in films such as Being John Malkovich, I loved that movie, Paid in Full, The Notorious Betty Page, and You're Nobody Till Somebody Kills You. He's also been a part of numerous TV series like Law and Order, Numbers, Grey's Anatomy, and Survivor's Remorse, but we all now know him as the complicated, to say the least, and no-nonsense family man, John Murphy, on our favorite television show on HBO, The Leftovers. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us here on The Living Reminders today.
Oh, absolutely. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Is The Leftovers becoming what you thought it would be for you?
Blake, I have to be honest. I didn't have a lot of expectations. And because I don't, or those of us who are on the show this year, we're not coming from the history of having the book behind us to draw from necessarily. We are in a, you know, we're on a journey of discovery, and it's sort of unfolded as we've gone along. So nothing has made a lot of sense. I don't know if that means, of course the writing is incredible and all that, but what I'm saying is that it is such layered writing, it is such new and inventive in its sort of departure from the book, which is not a huge departure, but it is a slight, different look at, I shouldn't use the word different, that's not the right word. Of course we're extending on the Garveys in their journey to look for, happiness and regain balance in their lives. And so we bring the story to Texas, and it's a part of it. It's a part of their journey, but we're not supported by the initial sense of the book. So we don't really have a lot to fall back on. So we're kind of just working along with the writers as they come up with ideas, which, you know, it's interesting in its process, because Damon, as you know, or I'm sure you've heard by now, he's insanely close to the vest with information. So he may, for instance, initially, for me, he did not give me a lot of thoughts about who John Murphy in his mind was. He just, from what we auditioned with him through the process, go play. He said, go play and we'll find each other down the road in the story. And, I'm a theater guy. So this was so difficult for me to understand and process, but it's been so rewarding to do. But it is a process on many different levels. I'm still processing the way to work with not having a beginning, middle, and end, but just having a now. You know what I mean? And you don't know what you're doing until the next episode rolls in, and then by the time it rolls in, a day or two later, we're ready to go. You know what I mean? So it's amazing. I mean, the process is amazing. The Damon and Tom, they are part of this collective voice that we have in our time now. That I think we owe it to them to continue to develop.
Yeah, we actually had the pleasure of speaking with Tom Parada just before the season began, and it was a very interesting conversation. He was bringing up the idea of, what are we here for, and what is the meaning of what we're here for? And I really think that The Leftovers really tries to not only talk about it, but engage it, tackle it, and analyze it. And it forces you to meet the material halfway. I think it excels at that very well.
I absolutely agree. And the point is not really whether you come up with an answer or not, but the beauty is in the wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? Because, what if there are no answers to this stuff? How will we ever know? By the time somebody does come up with an answer, we may not be here, right? So that the wrestling of coming up with an answer to these things, the beauty in that journey gives us all some place to put our energy and forces you to come up with maybe your own take on it, which at the end of the day, that's what it's going to be. I mean, there was an old joke that I heard a long time ago, and I can't remember the joke now, but sort of the gist of it was, different people from different religions all ended up in hell, and they were sitting around, and they were saying, well, who did you think it was? And he said, man, I thought it was Buddha. Man, well, who did you think it was? It's like, yeah, you know, I thought it was Allah. And, like, they all ended up in hell. So, like, you know what I mean? So that the idea is almost like, you know, we're brought into this world. There's free will for most of us who are, at least in our culture here, with, you know, this free will. And then you almost have to sort of put together your own life manual. Because who knows if it's all right or wrong? Who knows? So that when you see these characters on the show wrestling with moving on and wrestling with their lives, you then have to question where you fall and where you're going to go and what happens for you in the midst of, you know, this crazy thing called life.
Had you read The Leftovers book with this in mind, or watched season one before getting cast as John Murphy in season two?
Yeah, here's the thing. Like, so The Leftovers book is definitely on my list, right? But what happened was, because of the way the process and the auditions went, for me, you know, I've heard all these fancy stories about people who have meetings, you know, but that's not for all of us. So, but for me, I went about four auditions in, and when it's all said and done, we started work 3 days later. So it was like being shot out of a cannon for real. So by the time, you know, I sort of, and I'm talking about, this is a major move. Like, you're kind of moving your life, you know, for an indefinite amount of time. But, you know, you're definitely making a major move because, you know, the thought is that that you're going to be here for 10 months and maybe longer. So you just kind of grab as much as you can, what you can in storage and tuck some other stuff away, and you kind of do all this stuff and you get here and you try to, you know, get focused and be here for the first day. And so in doing that, it became about initially cramming the first season to find the feel of the show, to see where the show was going, if because at that point we didn't have a lot of information. We just knew that the first season finished the book, or that was the point that they were going to take off from the book and start to you know, put it in the hands of the writers and their ideas in the room. And so, knowing that, the importance of watching the first season for me was about tone, context, understanding Damon's voice, understanding Tom's voice, the visions of the writers. So it became a really important and probably the quickest way to get acclimated in the world of the play, as it were, because I just found myself so anxious. I wouldn't say, you know, I hate to say overwhelmed, but it was just anxious. Like, I could not figure out how to do enough for what exactly I needed to do to be prepared, because our season wasn't going to be based on the book. But I definitely wanted the tone and the feel and the understanding of logistics and of the storytelling. And I really fell in love with it.
Now, to piggyback off of that, what exactly does this role mean to you at this point in your career?
See, that It's a good question, and it's also like one of those one of those questions that are like it makes me think of how excited you get when a magician pulls a rabbit out of the hat. You know, you're so glad to see this bunny, and the bunny's alive, and it's a beautiful bunny, and you're this and that. But the real craft is about all of the other stuff that went into being able to produce the bunny and it still be alive, if you know what I mean, you know? And so, like, it's amazing to be working with HBO and working with Tom Perrotta and Damon Lindelof, absolutely. But it really, the satisfying part of it is that it's a collective of artists who are challenging. It's the kind of material that's involved, rather than it being just a show on a network or any of that. Because, you know, other theater people, working actors who, you know, work sometimes, don't work, you know, people get so excited when you get a job in general. As an actor, you are just floored that you have a job most of your career. And then there comes a point when you've figured out, or when you want to be a part of your personal statement or what you want to offer to our collective consciousness in terms of your energy, your work, the conversation that you have. And when you find a team, when you're part of a collective, and you're all moving in a similar direction with intention, purpose, artistry, it becomes, it's not a job. You know what I mean? It's an honor. I mean, the fact that people get upset at the show, the fact that people are having a reaction to the show, I think is a great thing. I hate when people, I can't say that I'm thrilled when people are, sound like they are going to challenge the notion of The Leftovers having the Murphys be a part of it. Like, I can't say I'm crazy about that, but I can say that there is... there's a great satisfaction in the fact that you are a part of something that people are reacting to and engaging with, because then at least we have a chance to challenge. And without a challenge, everything goes on the way it is, and we don't have a chance to change.
So with that in mind, then, who, like, you talked about the inclusion of the Murphys, and to be honest, the things that I've heard have been pretty positive. So it's good. It's enlightening to know that you are aware of the outside world commenting on The Leftovers. I think that's exciting to know. But who is John Murphy to you, and do you think he's a leader?
Well, let me just clarify really quickly. We have great and brilliant young actors on the show. Giovanna Depot and Jasmine Savoy Brown, they represent that, the sort of, they are in the know with all things social media, whether they, actually pay attention all the time or not. But you can always count on, not necessarily them, but their friends or people they know to send them a note to say, hey, this is what's happening, this is what's going on. Because for the most part here, all of us are still in this bubble of working and trying to finish out the season. But as we go along and as some of the trailers have started to happen, certain, people send you notes and this and that, this and that. So I will say, all the years I spent on stage reading, and I will get back to your question, and just remind me, Blake, because I'm taking off. Well, I'm feeling good with this one, Blake. I'm running with it, baby.
Just let it flow.
Yeah. So I'm trying to let it flow. And Mary, how you doing? Are you all right?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm just listening. Okay. I love it.
Okay. All right. I just want to make sure we're still focused. You know, the hardest thing about reviews in all the years I've been on stage is that if you get a bad review and you still have a 3-month run, you have to do the show for the 3-month run or until it closes, knowing that you got a bad review. And then if you got a great review, there's this sense of everybody's coming to see you prove why the review was so good. And so you get kind of put in this place of negotiating your emotional responsibility to a review because it's meant so much to you. You know what I mean? Blake, you asked me a question about John Murphy and who he is to me, I think. For me, it's such an interesting question, Blake, because I don't know that I'm totally aware of all of the layers of who John is at this point. I think we're still discovering, and I hope that there's more to come. I just know that in this, a snapshot of his life at this point, for me, John is, he's imperfect, but he's trying. And I love something about that combination, because I believe that the only thing you can do perfectly in life is not be perfect. And I struggle with that. So now you're looking at a process like this, and you're coming from the stage where you have a little bit more control in your performance. I know that what I'm doing counts on so many levels because everybody's watching everything that I do. And then you come to a process like this where the sense of trust in this process is really about looking at what the writers have sent down, and these guys are brilliant, so you have to trust that. And you're committing to the material, and you're putting it out. Then that material, that raw material, goes away. You have no idea exactly what just happened. You have no idea how it's going to be cut, edited, or brought back, or any of that. I mean, you have a sense of it from the script, but I'm talking like in that kind of way where you just absolutely know. Like we don't know. Some things can be taken out or moved or this, that, and that. And then when you see it come back and you have a team like this, it's not only a relief, but it sort of renews your faith in the idea of trusting and continuing to let go in terms of what comes out of the storytelling. Because letting go is a huge part of working in this way, you know, especially for series. You have to swallow so much material quickly. You have to bring it in, throw it against the wall, and then keep moving to the next thing. And you tend to want to hold on when you want it to be, you know, when you don't think you got all of the juice out of it that you wanted to, but it's gone. You have to let it go. And I have to say that it's so scary. But we have a team of people here. We have a great team of people here who have just I mean, the snippets that we've seen so far have just been beautifully shot and well, and true to what it feels like that we've done as a collective. I couldn't be more thrilled.
So it sounds like the imperfections and allowing the character to be the character is what gets you juiced up about John Murphy. He's certainly someone that is trying, and whether he's failing or succeeding, I think that is part of the conversation. But one of the things that struck me from the premiere, obviously we've all seen it, is that John seems like he's the keeper at the gate for Jardin. You know, he says this thing where he says, you know, about Isaac, he says he's selling lies and folks are buying them. And so is this his justification for burning down Isaac's house? Like, then, you know, is he really the keeper at the gate?
Interesting notion of being a keeper of the gate. We're going to learn more about the town and see some different things play out. But the thing about John is, based on some personal stuff for him, he has made a decision to take, to really participate in the world in a way that is he's going to set some things right. And being a keeper of the gate for the town, who made you God is the question, right? Who gave you permission to do that? And the thing is, I don't know that anybody did. I think that John is taking it on. How do I get around and not? Because I don't want to give a lot of this away.
Well, let me say this. Does he feel responsibility for his town?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I don't know that John was appointed any special position by anyone in particular, but there are reasons that John sees himself being a person who will right some moral wrongs, and if no one else is going to step up against people, things in this town that could be morally corrupt, then he will.
Is that what gives him his justification for burning down Isaac's house?
Yeah, and I think we'll see more. And I'm going to reserve any judgment about that, but I think we will see more. We will start to understand why later. That's one of the things that, you know, Damon Lindelof and Tom Perrotta do so brilliantly, is that they're going to make you wait for some answers. So you don't get it all right away. But, you know, when you do get it, you'll be able to, agree or disagree with it.
The fabulous Regina King plays your wife, Erica, and I'm almost madly in love with her. She obviously loves John, and they've created a warm, loving family together. But is it safe to assume that John has made her aware of all his doings, like burning down houses and the many sides of his character? Like, Erica didn't seem too sympathetic to as she stitched up Isaac.
Yeah, and let me start with the end of the question, with the end of this notion first. You know, the way this writing works is I have not called Damon too many times to get into, conversations about the nuance of the writing, because I just think that the guy is doing so much all the time that he needs time to do what he has to do. If there's something that comes up that I'm absolutely stuck on, then I'll call. But other than that, I try to go in and I try to make a choice about it and challenge Mimi as a director to give me perspective or lend a voice or, yeah. But I think it's important for the actor to show up with a take, an angle, show up with something, and then we can sort of shift, shape, and mold it into where we want it to go. So this idea of how Regina may have played, you know, a moment here or there, I think, you know, some of this would be player's choice, and some of this would be you're trying to interpret where the writer wants to go and infuse that with a sense of what the character needs to move forward. And for example, for me, this moment when you mention that, I'm saying that the beauty in it, whether it's right or wrong again, that the beauty in it is John's wife has taken and supported John's position in and with someone that he is having a bit of conflict with. Yet, her duty as a doctor to the community and the service that she's providing, she did not refuse that. But her tone about doing it could and may well be, as far as I'd like to think, as John is her husband, could be that she is in this ride of life with John. Now, is it right? Now, do you always take your wife's side and everything? You know, some do, some don't. Mm-hmm. And I won't say that this is, I'm just thinking about it from John's perspective and what I have hoped for this family. One of the things that I asked Dana, and that we did talk about early on, before any of the scenes or any of the story was ultimately revealed, was I said to Damon, look, I hope that I'm able to play a father that has love in this family, love and connection. This is really, for me, I'd love to, whether we start there, in there, or we find it, I would like to see and to know that this family, they love each other. They don't have to be perfect. We can go all around the world, come back twice, and then sit down on Sunday. But there's got to be some love somewhere in this journey. And I saw Damon, you know, his eyes rolled around his head a little bit. Then he kind of cocked his head to the side and gave that wry smile. And he said, I got it.
Yeah, there's this great scene. There's this great scene, obviously, in the beginning of the episode when they're piling books on your character. And yeah. I always felt like that's a really good introduction to the family, because ultimately there is love there, no matter what. You can obviously tell. I mean, just from the very beginning. And you know, here's a funny question for you: are you actually a deep sleeper in real life?
You know what, Blake? I tend not to be a deep sleeper. And recently I've been made aware, and I've had to rethink, like, how important sleep is to the overall sense of well-being, right? I mean, it really is connected to so many things. The fact that you don't get 8 hours of sleep. It's connected to so many unbelievable things. And the next time we talk, I'm going to have my list, because I would love for your listeners and, you know, anybody else who's hearing this, just to be reminded of some of the things that happen to people because they don't get enough sleep. And I've been guilty of it. I mean, I work at night generally. I've been a theater hound for years, so, you know, usually I'm getting off at 11 o'clock at night or, you know, whatever, and then by the time you get to bed, you're, you know, it's whatever time. And what happens is generally after you perform, you get inspired, or, you know, you get adrenaline pumping, so going to bed after performances can be difficult. And then it sort of turns your clock around a little bit, and so I've been guilty of that a lot.
So when Erica and the kids, they stack the books on John, it's like I said, it's a great scene. But the thing one of the things that jumped out at me was that those books include biographies about Mandela and Lenin and the book The Road to Terror, with exhaustive notes being taken in each. What can you say about John's literary choices here?
Goodness, Blake, you guys are great. Oh, man, are you hearing this? I mean, listen, I, when we started to think about the scene and came in and sort of put the scene up on a seat, there was a sense of, we want this notion of the layering of books and different deep thinkers and the amount of knowledge of what John was searching for. What is he looking for? And I don't know that it came down to a satisfying answer, but I do know that as we reveal things along the journey for John in the show, this idea of the way other powerful leaders have led their causes and fought for their causes, to know that he's considered that, researched it, reads about it, is very, it's one of those things that that I think we appreciate about him, because you know that there's an attempt to find his way in the way he's going about things. And I think some of those people that he's read about, not everybody's gone about things in the way Dr. King has. I mean, there are other leaders that have gone about their causes in many, in a lot of just, there have been a lot of horrible things that people have done to be leaders. And the fact that he's read about that, he's read about Dr. King, I think it's so interesting. We don't have, as of yet, being the first episode, we don't have all of the answers as to what that all will ultimately amount to. We just know that that's a part of where he's starting.
Well, it's funny because in the show, it reminds me of these books and what you're describing as these leaders and what they have to do. And sometimes it isn't very good. It reminds me of almost this kind of somewhat throwaway of a line when John says, "We don't have any friends." Mm-hmm. Is that by design, or is that like, or is that just because these people burning people's houses down?
Is it by design, or is it because he's burning people's houses down? I think that is one of those throwaway lines that will, if deeply considered, will give you a little bit of insight as to where John is in his faith of humanity at this point. Mm-hmm. And because he's starting here, it doesn't mean that he ends here. But it also, for the moment, I think contextualizes a bit of where he's coming from when we find him in his journey. I want to wait till some things play out to go on. Like, that's something that I think we should come back to in the next one, because it's a layered notion, and I'm not sure that we're gonna get a satisfying answer yet to what that ultimately means.
Well, you talked about faith, John's faith in humanity, and something, you know, tells me from the first episode that he's not particularly religious or he's not particularly superstitious either. But there is this almost hesitation to grab the spoon out of the disposal when he gets Isaac's reading, or when he doesn't want to eat the pie dropped at his doorstep. It feels like John fears a comeuppance for all of his sins that are coming.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is I think there's that's one of the great things about the way, you know, our writers put these characters together, is that they're contradictions. And I think these are indications of him struggling in some capacity with, you know, his whole with the idea of being superstitious and I all of those ideas that are that John would say that you watch him, you hear what he says, and then you see what he does. And I always think that the character of a person is best shown through their actions. And so for me, and again, you know, we haven't had a powwow necessarily with the writers about it, but, you know, he is mindful of this warning that Isaac has given him. And although he doesn't necessarily, he has a strong position with what Isaac represents and who he is, he does consider, what if?
Mm-hmm. So, right? I mean, like, you talk about actions and them speaking louder than words. I think this is most evident in something as subtle as pawning that pie off on the Garveys, even though he thinks it might be poisoned. This seems like pretty indicative of that kind of contradiction or John's divided moral character. Doesn't it seem like that?
It does. I would hate to think that John would, you know, would absolutely poison somebody. You know, I think having this warning, John has gotten this warning, and how do I talk about this without sort of giving it away? This is another one of these things that are kind of tricky because, so he's been given a warning, mm-hmm. and I will say that there is a part of John that does not subscribe to any of that, any of the miracles that people feel like they're getting, or that Isaac is able to pull off. There's something that fundamentally that John doesn't believe about that. Yet he does heed a warning. He does consider a warning that Isaac has sort of put out there. And again, it's a beautiful contradiction. It's not anything that figured out that, you know, the story would hold without having to answer that right away. Because initially I was stuck for a minute, and then remembering that we still have a journey to go on, I was able to just kind of, you know, go with it. And I know that our writers, once they, if they feel like that this is a direction that we need to flesh out, that they will. Mm-hmm. But again, it's one of those contradictions so far that we just do not, that we're not concrete about one way or the other. This is what I mean. That's one of the tricky, that it's so good that you've picked these things up, and they are some of the things that in working on this, again, it's a trust exercise. I'm saying, you know, Blake, just fall. Mary will catch you. She will have you. Because to answer that would, I think, take away from some of the possibility of journey that we have to take. And John is still in development as a human being throughout this season. You know, he's still got some lessons to learn, you know?
So where is John in believing about the magic or the supernatural? Or again, we talked about miracles. So that leads me right to the direct question of, does John believe in miracle? Does he believe it's a special place? And does he attach any specific meaning to why no one departed?
Like the great thing about this, and I mean, when you talk about a family, you talk about a strong-willed father who is rearing children, you find that his belief in the whole idea of miracles is not what his son's beliefs are. And he doesn't impose his beliefs on his son. He allows his son to live his life fully. And he may challenge it from time to time, his belief, but he's not going to be an overbearing parent who says, you must believe this or that. John is not one to believe in miracles, and we will know why at some point. And you know, and the way that the journey is laid out speaks to, again, this idea that nobody or place is perfect, and the only thing you can do in life is not be perfect. I think that that is really one of the tenets of John's life, is just that idea. And I think through that, you know, there's this notion I had from living in the South and from living in the North, both long times in my life. And one of the things that I noticed is that people in the South, and this is a generality, so, you know, it's just amusing more so, when I think about life in the two places, in the South, people trust people till they give you a reason not to. In the North, people don't trust anybody until you give them a reason to. And I think John is so, you know, being in Texas, the average person would be a little more trusting of people until they gave him a reason not to. John, I don't know that he's that trusting of people.
Mm-hmm. He sounds like a kindred spirit to me, because if you can't tell from my accent, I'm from Boston. So I'm a Northerner, and trust me, I don't trust anybody.
it works like that. And then, you know, I'm making generalities about North and South, but I think that kind of happens in the world. Like, people take one side or the other side, and then, you know, some people may fall in the middle and they just kind of go with which way the wind blows. But, you know, now, I spent a lot of time in the Bronx as a kid, and just one of the things that, you know, just this idea that you did not speak to people. You can get on an elevator with people and nobody would say good morning, but you go down South and everybody's, how are you? Come on in. Y'all have a seat. You know, this is hospitality. Everybody was just friendly, this and that. And that didn't happen in the North. And while I think there is a sense of that, that in the South, you can give that off, you can portray that. And as a matter of fact, they do. I think the Murphys are very welcoming and inviting and this and that. But John also has this part of him that is careful.
Yeah, it sounds like there's like an inner mechanic there, or inner mechanics within John that prevent him from allowing anybody to really come in, or allowing anything outside of what he absolutely trusts in his little bubble of peace. Let's just put it that way. So, I mean, do you think it's safe to assume that his son is probably a little bit more in tune with the idea of miracle, you know, miracle, the national park, or and John is much more skeptical of the idea of miracle, the national park?
Yeah, I think that's very fair to say. I think John Michael, played by Devon Adipo, who's wonderful in this. I mean, young actor's great. I think that he is set up, his character is set up, Michael, the character of Michael is set up to have a sense of religion, a sense of what it is, because of this, his sense of religious belief thus far in this. I think he is much more open to being helpful, reaching out toward others, goodwill toward others. He is absolutely in that way, you know, he shows goodwill to thy neighbor for certain. And it's a wonderful contrast in that, you know, he has a sister played by Jasmine Ward Brown. And, you know, she is neither here nor there when it comes to that as we meet her character. She's a little more happy-go-lucky, Evie, she's happy-go-lucky as we sort of see her in the beginning. And we start to take a journey with these two, and we contrast this young man who is very religious with the happy-go-lucky sister, and they're twins. And they just don't see the world the same way, which I thought was really great. It's like, I really love how it's set up.
Yeah, it seems like a great setup, because, you know, by the end, you know, Evie, you know, spoiler alert if you haven't seen it yet, but she disappears at the end of the episode, and it's left you, John, a little on edge, because it seems like he gets along with Evie a little bit better than Michael.
You know, here's what's interesting about that. I think, in terms of getting along, I would hope that he loves both of his children deeply. And I think that the path that Michael's on is, it challenges something deep in John. It challenges a deep sense of John's, a deep belief that John has, but he doesn't take that away from Michael. He doesn't strip that away from him, nor does he stop loving Michael because he doesn't agree or doesn't see things the same way, which I think is really beautiful.
Let me rephrase that then, because I think that was poor phraseology. I think it's better and more applicable to say that he relates to Evie a little bit better. And like, you have that great scene with the softball and they're pitching, and it's like they're competing against each other almost until your character, John, has to give up because his hand gets hurt. You know, I thought that was a beautiful little scene between the two.
Yeah, I do too. I love that. And there's a great payoff for that. I think he relates differently, and I do think that John is working to make it better. I think he's working to make the connection with his son better. I think he, because his daughter hasn't yet had any she's still doing her job, which is to be a teenager, to be a kid, and come into her own. And there has been nothing that she's taken on that has challenged the stasis of the of that relationship between these two. So at this point, they're still able to do, to have a relationship that's working with these two without any challenges yet. I do think, you know, he tells her that, you know, be home by a certain time. So he's involved and he's engaged. And the fact that they do have that, they're playing softball together, we know that he spends time with Evie. And we could only assume that he would spend time with Michael if Michael would stay still long enough. But Michael's on his own journey. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of thing that was so important to me, because I think you can deduce, or one can deduce, that, you know, that's what we want to do as parents, is spend time with our kids. Like, that's the most valuable thing that we can do, is spend time with any of our loved ones. That's more valuable than, you know, the cars that you buy or whatever, is your time. And I love that that's the currency that, you know, that you see, that, because as we know, you know, John's not buying kids fancy things in this series at all. But what he is doing is giving the greatest gift that he can, which is his time. And he's willing to do that with Michael.
It seems like John obviously is a family man, and obviously with the party scene, it's very evident that he is in touch with his family. But one of the things that surprised me about this, and maybe this is the Northern in me in saying this, but, you know, it seems like John is really open about himself in front of his kids too. I mean, in front of these new neighbors, like talking about his prison time and saying he was coming up for murder. And why is John so open about this?
That's a good question. And I, you know, when I looked at that initially, I thought, I wonder if this is kind of the dance of a rooster. In other words, you have another man that's moved next door. John's a man. He's a neighbor. And, you know, John's got a sense of right and wrong and who runs the town that you've moved into. And to, you know, there's something about people telling you who they are that can, I think, allow you to let your guard down sometimes. It's like, you're not going to find out later that this is who I am. No, this is what I've done. I stand in my truth of who I am, and it is what it is. And I think that he starts a relationship, a new relationship with new people coming into this small town in an absolute honest way. So I do think that it's probably not the way that most of us would handle that. But I've run into a few people in my life who pretty quickly, you know who they are. And it's almost like, you know, you can kind of trust those. You can kind of trust those people when they stay consistent with who they introduce themselves to be. You know, you kind of trust that, and you can kind of know what you're dealing with up front and choose to deal with it or not to deal with it, but you're not guessing all along when they tell you who they are. Other people, you learn things about them along the way after you've known them for 5 years, you know, and then they drop a bomb on you, and you're like, oh my God, I never thought that, you know, blah, 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 blah. But John is absolutely, no, this is what it is. And there's a slight enjoyment that he has about the shock that registers for people.
It's almost like he's testing people.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think it is a bit of a test to see what you do with this information and where do we go from here. Mm-hmm. And if there's going to be a problem, we're going to know it now. And if there's not, then there's not.
Kevin, where can our listeners find you, either on the internet or Twitter, social media? Where can they find you and get more from you?
I am on Twitter at Kevin T. Carroll on Twitter. And I have a Facebook page, which I'm currently going to revamp. There's a fan page, Kevin T. Carroll, on Facebook, which I would love people to stop by and check out.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for your time. We are way over the allotted amount of time that we scheduled, and I just want to say thank you so much for spending so much time with us. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, Blake. I really appreciate you guys calling, and this has really given me a chance to work out some of the things that we've been through, because we've been stuck in the bubble for a long time now, and it's interesting to reflect on a lot of these questions at the moment.
Thank you once again to Kevin Carroll and for everyone at HBO for having him on the show with us today. That was awesome. Blake, what did you think?
He was really great. I mean, it's hard for him because I know he has to talk around circles a little bit, because it is indeed just the first episode of this entire season. So there's a lot to play out, you know, and I think he did a good job talking around some specific spoilers. But one of the things that really struck me was knowing that all these actors and the crew and everybody has been in this bubble and down in Texas, right? And they don't really know what's happening around them, except mm-hmm. for getting some bits and pieces here and there, hearing good things, hearing bad things, not even really knowing what the finished product is like, right? Yeah. They're in this bubble. And it was great to hear him say, like, thank God for you guys. Thank God I'm actually here to talk to you, because I've been dying to talk about this. It makes you wonder, like, what kind of secrecy is surrounding
it,
you know?
Seriously, like, what is next? What other things does he have up his sleeve?
Because you know he wanted to talk about it, right?
Oh, my gosh,
You know he was just, he was dying to get up. And he was so careful to be like, oh, my God, how do I say this? How do I not say that? It's really crazy. And it's hard for him to not do that, because John, the character John Murphy, is a really complicated guy. And we already know that by just seeing the first episode.
Yep.
He has this family that he loves. And obviously he loves them. Obviously he's a family man, right? You know it. You see him interact with the children, with his wife. But he's burning people's houses down because they don't fit his mold. And you can tell that he feels like, people got to answer to me. And if they don't answer to me, then it's going to be a problem. We're going to have...
Aside from that, cricket.
Yeah, that cricket kind of rules his life.
It's like the deer. We're going to talk about that more in the recap.
That's right.
That cricket, I'm like rolling with it.
But, you know, the books that this guy is reading, right? You know, the books with Lennon and all this stuff. I think he's more than just a bad guy, like the way that he's being painted right now.
He's not reading J.K. Rowling.
Well, clearly he's not. I mean, he's not going. He's not doing, like, you know, Alohomora, you know, anymore, or, you know, anything like that.
You're a wizard, Harry.
I don't think he does that. Episky. No, he doesn't do those kind of...
Episky. For those of you who aren't on the up and up with your Harry Potter wizard spells.
You're a wizard, Harry.
You got to get your head in the game, all right?
Well, what I'm thinking is this. I think he's more than just a villain. And I think he's even more than just an antagonist either. He is a complicated man. And you could see that he was struggling with how to characterize John Murphy. And in the end, I think we're going to end up liking John Murphy in a weird way.
He burned down that nice guy's house.
I know. But you know what I honestly think of is, I think of bringing in Game of Thrones to this conversation. I think of Jaime Lannister. Spoiler alert, by the way. Jaime Lannister, you know,
pushed a kid out of a window.
Off of a window and paralyzed him. And he's banging his sister on the side.
I feel very uncomfortable with both of these gentlemen. Listen.
But what I'm getting at is this. Later on, you come to really like Jaime Lannister.
Yes.
You come to, like, he's my favorite character. He's my favorite character in the books, and he's my favorite character in the show. And look how he started off. So I think we're going to end up liking John in a weird kind of way.
I don't know if I'm ever going to trust this guy. Not going to lie.
Listen, I also want to thank Brian Davids of the Film Schlubs podcast.
See
thank
that
you very
five
much.
Times five.
I know. He helped us with these questions. I consulted on him. And actually, he's going to have a featured segment on our show going forward, the Brian Davids Thought of the Week. So I'm looking forward to that. Anyway, my love, are you ready to close out the show?
Yes, we are.
All right, let's do it.
All right, everybody, the season has begun. That means we want to chat with you, okay? We can't get enough of this leftovers chatting. So reach out to us on Facebook, on Twitter, or on Instagram. Our handles are all the same. It is Living Reminders.
And if the social media ain't enough for you, you can always email us at livingreminders@gmail.com.
And you can always find our past episodes, our previous interviews, learn more about Blake and myself and all the other things that we do through our website. It is www.thelivingreminders.com.
And if you go to thelivingreminders.com, there's this little button on the tab that says support. And there are a bunch of ways you can help support this podcast, one of which is Patreon. If you'd like to donate $1, $2, or $125 billion to this podcast, we would gladly accept it. You can rate and review us on iTunes. But you know, the most important thing you can do for a free podcast is tell a friend. If you liked this interview, if you liked our show, and you love The Leftovers and you can't get enough of it, tell a friend. Tell somebody you know. Put it on Facebook. Put it on Twitter that there's this show, The Leftovers, and this amazing podcast, The Living Reminders, with this lady and this guy with the weird Boston accent. And that'd be a great help to us.
It would also be really great if you could head on over to iTunes. Leave us a rating and a reviewing, and heck, check out those other reviews. And if you like what they say, click yes, that it was helpful. So one of the recent reviews was by Jogoholic. I wonder if it's about Justin Throws jogging. Anyway, Jogoholic said, loved these podcasts as it brings us all closer to the episodes and the characters. Two talented interviewers that make it feel comfortable enough that I feel like I'm sitting with them as they comment and interview. They're down to earth, well informed, and draw some interesting conclusions, or at least good guesses, about the many mysterious aspects to this deeply layered and complex show. If you're confused, they may help, or they may make you just more confused, depending upon which level you're on. Sorry, that's just how the show is, and I love it. It's all fun, entertaining, and informational. So thank you, Jogoholic, and anyone else who wants to have their review read, just head on over to iTunes, and we might actually get to read it.
Hey, and also, don't forget to check out the Living Reminders blog. You can find that at livingreminders.blogspot.com, or go to livingreminders.com and just hit the button blog.
Until next time, ladies and gents, I'm Mary Larson.
My name's Blake.
And we're still here.